I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas Cityans want their roads repaired, entertainment districts revitalized, housing to be affordable, and the list goes on. But what happens when the infrastructure costs far exceed the city's budget by more than $1 billion? Today, one architect explores the lifestyle choices that have impacted the city's costly infrastructure. Find out why we're building cities we cannot afford to maintain, and how Kansas City can reduce the strain on its overstretched budget. Then, the Brazilian jazz artist whose latest album reflects her strong relationship with poetry. I'll ask the Grammy-winning singer how getting started at the age of 3 impacted her career. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Are the needs of cities like Kansas City becoming so great that its residents can no longer afford them? Even Mayor Quentin Lucas wonders sometimes. We're going to ask him about that here this morning. We're going to hear him right now describe a response to my question a couple of weeks ago. Has Kansas City gotten too expensive?
We have in many ways overbuilt. But another thing is we have to ask fundamentally, what are cities for? How many other municipalities actually participate as much as we do in Kansas City? Hmm. Have programs like 1% for the Arts. Make sure that there's minority and women representation goals on every project, public project that we do. And make sure that we're actually supporting our hospitals in our community through our own tax dollars as a city. There are significant investments that Kansas City makes each day to support this region and continues to. But at the same time, we have got to make sure we're taking care of the poorest in our community.
That's our topic here today. We complain about potholes and worry about whether we have enough police officers. We need tens of millions of dollars in new affordable housing, not to mention tens of millions more to pay off the cost of rebuilding the downtown. And did I mention the cost of replacing a single bridge across the Missouri River, the Buck O'Neill Span, will cost $200 million. So here's a question. What if our cities have become, in a word, unaffordable? What if we can't keep up with all that needs to be done? With us to talk about this, Dennis Strait is a principal at the Kansas City office of the Gould Evans Architectural Firm. He'll be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library tomorrow, and we'll have the details on that in just a few moments. Dennis, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Are we at a point where we no longer can afford our cities, Dennis, including perhaps our very own?
It feels like a rhetorical question, Steve,
yeah,
given the budget challenges that we have and that we've had for many years. It's not like this is the first year. And when you look at how much we're able to spend on maintenance of our infrastructure, it's not going up. And while you don't maintain your infrastructure, the cost to get caught back up again does go up.
That's the thing about infrastructure, right? If you don't deal with it today, it's more expensive tomorrow.
That's true.
Yeah. Tricky stuff. If you're a fiscal sense kind of person, then what you're saying here, Dennis, this can be a pretty scary place for us to be.
Well, it can be. And it's not unique to Kansas City. So part of what we're helping people understand is that this is a result of building our cities in a different way than we ever had. And we've built cities for 5,000 years as a human species, but only for the last few years have we built them the way that we've been building them. And it's a new strategy that we're just now learning how expensive that new strategy is to maintain.
And when you say we're building cities in a different way, what are you talking about?
Well, so up until 1950, we had a tradition of as humans for building cities. And you can see that play out in the first 80 years of Kansas City, Missouri, where we went from a small village on the Missouri River to within 80 years, we had a full-fledged city with 500,000 people living here. We had a strong downtown. We had an amazing park system. We also had almost 100 miles of streetcars. In 80 years from starting as a small village, and all we were doing was just following the pattern that other people had developed and learned from trial and error over 5,000 years of city building.
Hmm.
So that changed. That changed in 1950 when, at that point, most American families had a car. Now, it hadn't been that way before, but once that happened, the motivation for city building, the governor that regulated city building changed. Because now it wasn't so important for us to be close to each other. We could move around real easily, and we could get 15 miles in 15 minutes with no problem. So proximity became a different concern for city building, and we took full advantage of it because it liberated us in many ways to do things.
And very few cities have become as spread out as Kansas City, Missouri, right?
Well, we are in a more of a special class there. There are plenty of cities around the country who are as spread out as we are, but every city picked up on this opportunity when they could back in the middle part of the last century. We just happen to do a little more than others, so our challenge might be a little greater than others, but all cities are facing the same challenge.
So it's called sprawl, right? That's the word for what you're describing here, right?
It is. It is. But, you know, we're not focusing on that term only because it has a lot of baggage these days. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to help people understand their city in the way that we can now see it.
Why is sprawl so expensive?
Well, up until 1950, when we had 500,000 people here, we had a city that was about 80 square miles that we had developed. Now, it wasn't fully built out, but it was a fairly developed city by that time. And then we all had the ability to move around because we all started getting cars, and we started building at a different scale. So today our city is four times larger, but our population is hardly any different. So the simple math tells you that we now each have four times as much city to maintain as our predecessors did in 1950. And that's a pretty simple explanation for the infrastructure crisis. It's also an explanation for why we can't afford to build civically like we used to. If you look at the quality of how we built our park systems, of how we, you know, the quality that we invested into our civic buildings, we were just more prosperous as a city back in those days when we were more concentrated, when we had more resources concentrated with a tighter area.
And you're suggesting those days are gone because we are not so concentrated today. We are just the opposite of that.
Well, again, because we could, not because we knew that we were getting ourselves into this predicament. We really didn't, we hadn't in our history of city building ever faced this question about how costly it might be to spread out. But we certainly had all the motivations and interest in spreading out and taking advantage of single family homes and more park space, all those things. And that caused us to take advantage of that full tilt. Now we're starting to realize how expensive that development pattern is and how expensive it's made our cities. And frankly, it's that reason why we can't afford the cities that we build.
So you're saying that Kansas City was a willing partner in going along with this idea of expanding and expanding and expanding some more.
I am saying that, but not uniquely so. And it's not the government Kansas City. It's all of us in Kansas City followed that pattern. And it was followed all around the country. Again, this is not a unique predicament for Kansas City, Missouri, but it's one that we're starting to really talk about because of issues like potholes starting to be a real nuisance. Mm-hmm. And it's an early indicator of a large problem that we need to address.
That's interesting. So potholes to you, Dennis, suggests a sign of things to come perhaps down the road.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah. Because out of sight, out of mind, and unfortunately too much of our infrastructure is out of sight.
So when we think about infrastructure and how big Kansas City is, where is the price tag the heaviest? Is it in our roads? Is it in sewers? Is it in cleaning our water? What is it that's so expensive?
I think I'll answer that by saying it's the development pattern that's so expensive. And it could probably put better math to that to answer the question, but we easily identify that we're 10 times short of the funding we need for our streets. We know we have a court order against us for fixing our sanitary and combined storm sewer system.
A longstanding fight that's been, right.
So both of those are in the billions of dollars of cost, right? They're significant cost to us. But we also know that we face a challenge with the cost of our public safety. That grows every year. And if you look at the city budget over the recent years, it's grown proportionally more than anything else. And no surprise, because the last thing we're going to discount is our need for safety. So that cost keeps growing and taking up more of the available funding.
Dennis Strait is my guest. He's a principal at the Kansas City office of the Gould Evans Architecture Firm. He'll be presenting We've Built Cities We Can't Afford. That's the title of his talk at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch. More information, kclibrary.org. You mentioned other cities are very much in the same boat. Cities like, which ones?
Oh, you could almost pick any city. I don't know of a city that's flush with revenues to take care of its infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why we're on this advocacy, we're on this public awareness campaign is because Kansas City is early in this discussion. If you look at other aspirant cities that Kansas City would pattern after, it might be Denver or Portland or Austin. Those cities are inflated beyond many opportunities to fix the problems that they face. Mm-hmm. Affordable housing is an obvious one that we're having now. It's going to be very difficult for San Francisco to ever address its affordable housing because it's just so expensive of a place to be. Hmm. Whereas Kansas City is not. We're early in that cycle, and we have the opportunity to recognize that and to start building our city in a way that helps us generate better revenues, better returns on our infrastructure investments, and thereby have more resources to address the wide range of things that we try to address as a city.
You know, one way to measure the fiscal strain we're talking about here, Dennis, is in the amount of debt that we carry. I just came across one report on Patch that said of the 75 most populous cities, Kansas City ranks number 56 in the nation for fiscal health. The analysis by Truth in Accounting, it's a nonprofit government finance watchdog group, found Kansas City needs $1.6 billion to get out of the red, or $9,800 from each of its taxpayers. According to the watchdog's annual financial state of the cities report, Kansas City has $3 billion in bills and only $1.5 billion available in assets to pay those bills after capital and restricted assets are excluded. So there you go, right?
Yeah, I can't validate that information, but I can say that one of the things that cities don't do that we need to do is we need to recognize our infrastructure as a liability and not an asset. Once we build a street, it's not there for our use for the next 30 years unless we set aside money to replace it. And we don't do that. Cities don't set aside the replacement cost, the maintenance cost that's necessary for the infrastructure that we developed. And if we treated that like the liability it is, it would make that problem you just described even worse, but more realistic. Part of the problem we've gotten so numb to this issue of not having enough resources is that we just do the best we can every year, mm-hmm. as opposed to come up with a real plan for working our way out of it.
So what's going to happen then? What's going to happen to us as this problem grows worse? What signs might we begin to see beyond potholes that would suggest to us that we've got a big problem here?
Well, it's only going to keep getting more expensive, again, because infrastructure doesn't stay at the same condition. It continues to deteriorate, and the replacement cost just continues to go up. But I think we are in a good place in Kansas City because we're starting to have these discussions. And mm-hmm. it's not just these discussions about infrastructure, but it's healthy discussions about equity and shared prosperity that is changing the focus for our community. And the more that we start lining up those opportunities, the more strongly we can put together a plan that's strategic to lead in that direction.
You know, it's easy to sit back and sort of aim and at our city leaders for not doing what needs to be done. But it seems to me also that some of the problem here is on the voters themselves, who sort of expect our leaders to make our lives better through big infrastructure projects that we all like and all enjoy and make us proud to be Kansas Cityans.
Yeah, we do like getting things that we don't have to pay for, and we're all guilty of that.
Yeah.
And we try and make it clear that we're not pointing the finger at city officials in this regard because we've all built this city. This is a decision that each one of us makes every day in terms of how we move forward. And the more we understand the cost of our decisions, the more informed we can be about our actions.
Have our cities become too expensive for us? Can we keep up with all the maintenance required? That's our topic here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Dennis Strait is my guest, a principal at Gould Evans Architectural Firm. This has all led to this amazing statistic that we've talked about on this show any number of times, Dennis, that Kansas City has more highway lanes per person than any major American city. At least that used to be the stat. That becomes obviously very expensive for all of us to maintain.
In our presentation, we show a diagram that shows you could pave a lane from New York City to San Francisco, and then turn around and pave all the way back to New York City, and then you can still go up to the weekend to Portland, Maine, and then come back to New York. And by that time, you've built the 6,500 miles of lanes that we have in Kansas City.
Get out of here! That's an amazing stat.
Well, and it's one to appreciate the next morning after a snowfall while your street's not plowed. Right, we're trying to plow the entire country twice.
That's just amazing to me. That's just amazing. Has our thinking about sprawl is it starting to change, Dennis? Because you're suggesting here that people are starting to look at all this and what this is all going to cost us, not only in dollars, but in environmental impact. You're seeing some forward direction here?
Certainly. The more we share this conversation around town, the more we're finding people who are trying to work forward in a more productive way. Last week, we presented to groups as disparate as Johnson County Health Equity Committee, mm-hmm. Who are trying to find ways of building more productive communities so that people can age in place, those kinds of issues. We also presented to the Northland Council, Northland Chamber, last week, and folks came up and talked to me afterwards about how the economic development leaders are trying to encourage more walkable forms of mixed-use forms of development that that is more productive and able to help us have more return on our public infrastructure investments. Mm.
So what are among our options here? Can we reverse course and say our city's too big, we're gonna pull back by some measure and make it a different kind of city?
Well, I wouldn't recommend that.
Why not?
Because we have a lot of vital parts throughout our city. If you look, one of the things that that we're very pleased with is that last year the Kauffman Foundation funded a group called Urban 3 out of Asheville, North Carolina, to do a fiscal assessment of our city's infrastructure in ways that are easier for people to understand, and they present them through consumer-friendly graphics. And it shows that throughout our city there are areas that are productive, that are helping us get on top of this development or this infrastructure challenge. Unfortunately, there are just not enough of them. Hmm. And our real goal would be to recognize those areas where we have productive development patterns and do more of that, and just really concentrate on how we can build in productive ways all throughout our city.
When you say productive development patterns, what are you talking about?
Well, you can measure the cost of both building and maintaining infrastructure. And you can measure that and put that over a pro forma. And then you can measure the development that it creates. And you can measure its return in terms of taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, earnings tax in our city. Mm-hmm. And you can see if you've got a balanced equation there. And that's what we're encouraging, is for our city development to be managed more that way, more like you'd manage a portfolio of assets. Because once you see it that way, you can see where there are productive areas of our city that are generating enough revenue to take care of it, in many cases, pay back more than we need.
Can you give me an example of that, what you're talking about?
Well, our strongest example is not unique to Kansas City, which would be our downtown area. The downtown area is punching at five times its weight on average throughout the city in terms of the amount of revenue it kicks back to our city coffers. So in terms of paying its way, it's more than paying its way.
I thought we were spending millions of dollars a year in debt reduction for some of the Cornish development downtown in the Power and Light District.
Sure, and there are things like that we like to focus on, and TIF projects that we like to say are the culprits. And in some cases, that's true. But in balance, when you look at the downtown core, it is the economic engine for Kansas City, Missouri. And one of the things that Urban 3 found through their study is that we actually have two downtowns in terms of productivity. Our district around the Country Club Plaza, not just the commercial center, but the residential and business center around that is a very healthy and productive part of the town. And you can also see that productivity extending between downtown and the plaza throughout the Midtown area. All those neighborhoods are very productive places, and you can find productive places north and south from downtown too. So they're scattered throughout the city, and they give us a clear path on how we could move forward and build a more productive city that can afford to do all the things that we want to do as a community.
Are our cities becoming too expensive? That's our topic here. 816-235-2888 is our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dana from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I really wish you would have a program and talk about all of the tax revenue that we've lost through TIF, through tax abatements to large businesses. You look at a company like Amazon that pays zero tax. That really, when it moves into a city, creates all kinds of problems in terms of affordability. And, you know, even if we're not annexing different parts of the city and, you know, increasing sprawl, we still have to look at the maintenance costs and the pro forma formulas you were talking about earlier. We really need to have that be the center of the discussion. Because if we know how much tax revenue we need and we're not asking the businesses to pay that, that's kind of a no-brainer.
Dennis, is it a revenue question is what Dana's raising here?
Oh, I certainly appreciate Dana's point. And certainly it's a revenue question. We're out of sync in terms of our costs and our revenues. One of the things that Urban 3 did in their study was to evaluate recent TIF programs. And they found in many cases that TIF was a good investment for our city. Hmm. That, yes, it deferred taxes for the life of the TIF, but then going forward, it's generating good returns, and it has proved to be a good investment of city resources. Now, that's not always the case, and that's one of the reasons why being more thoughtful about where we use TIF funding would be one of the steps going forward, because there are other examples around town where TIF is not a long-term good investment. And just understanding that and making sure we're doing the good math we need to do to know that we're getting positive returns on our public investments is a recommendation.
You know, are there ways for us, creative ways perhaps, to reduce the amount of infrastructure we have to maintain, Dennis?
Well, one of the ways that we talk about it is now that we recognize we have so much pavement, you know, to go back and forth across the country with our streets, and that we can't afford those, then we need to be very thoughtful about building any more. About 20% of our city is not developed yet? Hmm. So how we develop that part of our city is really central to this discussion. We could continue to develop it in ways that that the numbers show simply just cost us money from that point forward. Or we can develop in ways that help us be more prosperous as a city, and that's what we're encouraging, is for us to focus on those types of development patterns.
And that would mean things like what?
Well, the Zona Rosa project up north was a more concentrated form of commercial development. There's talk in the Northland about making that more of a mixed-use center. And if we could build more housing into that pattern, you could get even a more productive area that's actually more vibrant and desirable as it has more people occupying and using it. So that's a recent example that's really not much different than our Brookside. You know, our Brookside was an original village center idea that put neighborhood retail in a way that people could easily walk and bike to it from the surrounding community. And that's a pattern that's a very productive way of building cities.
Well, where are this 20% of the city that hasn't been developed yet? Where is that?
Oh, it's scattered throughout the city.
Yeah.
Not so much in the central area, but north and south, you can easily find areas that are undeveloped. And when you look at this new mapping that the Urban 3 Group has done, they become obvious to you.
Do you see any signs that we're trying to reverse our sprawl, that people who are living out in the hinterlands, for lack of a better word, are beginning to move back toward the central city? Is that reverse migration going on or not really?
I don't know the stats on that, but we certainly have seen over the last 15 years a renewed interest in moving into the downtown area and to more of our central city neighborhoods. It's been great to see reinvestment happening throughout the original 80 square miles of Kansas City. And it's because there's many people that are interested in that type of walkable lifestyle.
And that's been a pretty remarkable change. Won't historians look back at the last 10, 15 years and say, wow, what happened there?
I hope so. And again, it's a good trend, and it's the trend we ought to encourage more, not just moving in, but again, building in development pattern or in productive patterns throughout our city so that we can create these more desirable areas of our city and more productive areas throughout our city.
Maybe a final point here, Dennis. Is our thinking about building in residential areas changing? I mean, you can build duplexes or small apartment buildings in some neighborhoods and maybe not detract that much. That's the way Kansas City used to be, you point out.
It is. I can't say that it's changing yet, but it's starting to become a conversation around the country. Because we're just starting to understand these patterns and starting to understand that single-family-only neighborhoods have a limited value to them. And if you look at the traditional way of building neighborhoods that you find all throughout central Kansas City and Hyde Park and east of Troost even, you find patterns that aren't only single-family houses. They're a mixture of a variety of housing types. And that's the key to us solving our affordable housing problem, is getting back to building neighborhoods that offer a wide variety of housing so that it's affordable to a wide variety of people. We've segregated ourselves into a way of zoning and building our city that doesn't provide for that diversity. And we need to learn from those patterns and learn how productive those patterns were, because those were healthy parts of our city, both socially and economically.
That's Dennis Strait from Gould Evans. He'll be talking about We've Built Cities We Can't Afford at 6:30 tomorrow evening at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch. More information, kclibrary.org. Dennis, thanks so much. Interesting stuff.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up after a short break, Grammy winner Luciana Souza. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Wishing for something more than junk mail in your inbox? I've got just the thing. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. You'll get highlights from the past week's episodes and a column from yours truly delivered each Monday to your inbox. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, are you willing to date someone outside your political party? We'll find out if dating across party lines is a romance breaker for some people tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Grammy winner Luciana Souza's latest album is about calm, tranquility, and simplicity. It's an album about longing, and that's the title of the disc, The Book of Longing. Critics say her strong suit is her ability to act as but one piece in a larger musical palette. The native of Brazil will be in town Saturday night to perform with the Folly. Let's listen to the opening track of The Book of Longing. This is These Things.
These are the books we read.
The Jazz Journalists Association has awarded the Best Female Jazz Singer Award to Luciana Souza twice in 2005 and 2013. She joins us now from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Luciana, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's great to be with you.
Well, this is an album of song, of poetry. There's some Emily Dickinson in here. There's some Edna St. Vincent Millay, some Leonard Cohen, some of your own work, too. You said of the album that what you were trying to do was to make it easy for listeners to be able to concentrate on the music and the words because, you know, good poetry requires deep concentration. I mean, it's so hard for so many people these days to get into that space. Why was that your goal?
Exactly because of that, because our lives are so hurried and the speed of everything seems to overwhelm most of us, humans, I find, you know, old and young. And I think it's really hard nowadays to just take time to lift words from the page. I mean, those of us who like newspapers, we may read the newspaper, but who really grabs a poetry book these days and just opens it up and tries to learn something about the world, about, you know, yourself? So I find that song arrives at people in an easier way. And why not honor these great poets? I mean, they were all dead by the time I set this music to poetry, so it was easier to get permission in that way, to just go to their masterful works and, you know, try to do something with it. Not that the poetry that they wrote needed me, but I clearly needed it.
Hmm. Well, one who what was still around, at least for a while when you began work on this album, was Leonard Cohen, mm-hmm. and you obviously seem to favor his work. He signed off on some of what you did here, right?
He did. It took a while. It's kind of an anecdote by now, but, you know, I've known Leonard for quite a few years. He actually was at my wedding. He's a friend of my husband's, or he was a friend of my husband's, but not really my friend. Just, you know, by association, I befriended him because he knew my husband for much longer than he had known me. And I had started sending his poetry to music the year actually this book came out, 2006, The Book of Longing. And I asked permission from him about 2007, 2008, and he said no. He denied me.
Really?
And he had somebody else working on it. He was in a relationship at the time, and maybe this person was working on some of that poetry. He just, you know, very politely said no. He was a really, really polite and a gentleman, really. But I stayed with it. And so through the years, I would go back, and I asked him twice, and he said no. And then the third time was a charm. And being Jewish, I know what that means, that with Jews, you always have to ask three times, you know, and finally get your yes. But I was delighted, and he actually heard some of what I set to music before he passed in a previous record in 2015, a record I put out called Speaking in Tongues, had two of the poems that I had already set to music. But I became kind of obsessed with him. And again, with him, he really doesn't need me to set his poetry to music because he's himself a songwriter. But I really feel like with poetry, I fall in love and then it's something that just possesses me. And then I must do it. Let's just say it that way.
Well, I want to ask you about how poetry, the impact it has on you. But I want to play one of the Leonard Cohen songs from The Book of Longing. Our intern, Chelsea Engstrom, absolutely loves this song. This is Night Song, again, based on lyrics from Leonard Cohen.
Songs of beauty fail. The forest closed.
singer Luciana Souza is my guest. You know, you just mentioned you have this very powerful relationship with poetry and can actually become obsessed with a poem. Why? And I'm wondering, why do you think these words can have so much power?
Well, because I think poetry is, again, as I said earlier, sort of a quiet thing that once it hits you, it really resonates with something within. It's a truth that I probably didn't dare tell myself. And I find like someone like Leonard so directly hits these points with me when he describes a scene or it takes a photograph that absolutely reveals everything you need to know. And I think if you allow yourself, if we allowed ourselves more time each day for a moment, I would call it a sort of a quiet meditation, but on some words, we would find these truths, and they help me live a better life. They help me become a better human. I mean, I don't mean this in a sort of high, you know, thing. Just a real, they bring, besides the joy that words bring to me, I think I feel compelled to go to poetry because it keeps revealing things to me that I feel I need to know, that other things in my life will not bring me.
And poetry, at least the poetry, good poetry, can do that so efficiently. You know, you have to sometimes read an entire novel to reach a truth that a poem can deliver, you know, in 40 seconds of reading.
Exactly. And someone like Leonard or Edmondson Vincent Millay, what they worked on was refining their words and really distilling the truth that they wanted to get at. And those of us who try to set poetry to music, I mean, what we have is this gift of this masterpiece that you can just borrow and say, okay, your words will be mine. And now I get to sing them in melody. And it's a lovely thing to be able to do. I mean, for me, it started as an exercise when I was still in maybe my teens. At the time it was Pablo Neruda, you know, done in Portuguese, my native language. But then I started to go to Spanish. And for me, it became a way to get to know the world and to know the lives of these poets has also helped me understand myself. I mean, if you think of how sensitive someone has to be to really sit and commit to writing poetry these days, or even, you know, hundreds of years ago, it really takes a certain kind of person. And I admire that. I admire the solitude, the sort of introspection.
Yes.
I'm attracted to that,
yeah.
Especially in a loud and fast world. I'm attracted to those people.
I really appreciate what you're saying. Hey, how do you come across new poets, Luciana?
You know, I subscribe to things like Poem a Day from poetry.org. And I'm hip that way. I can actually go to the internet and find a lot of new poetry. And then people knowing that I like poetry, they tend to send me things. And I'm always at a bookstore. There's a bookstore in Brentwood that we go to, and they have excellent suggestions for new poetry. And so I go in and I pick up a book. And, you know, sometimes my son is looking at something else at the kids' area, and I just sit there and I just borrow a couple of books and read through. And if I like something, I take it home.
You once said that the act of reading or even writing poetry is practically an art of resistance. What did you mean by that?
Well, again, I feel that you're going against what the world is pushing you to do right now, which is to be quick and fast and literal in a way, or untruth, you know, untrue in a way, right? We don't really know what the truth is anymore. We are so confused about things. And I think it's an act of resistance because it also puts you in a place of solitude, of silence.
Yeah.
And we feel we're connected and we're doing all these things. But meanwhile, I think we're more lonely than we've ever been, and not perhaps in a healthy way. So I feel poetry connects you again to that truth, and it forces you into a kind of introspection that I find healthy. It's always a friend. It's a companion.
Is poetry a response for you to the way you were raised? Because you've described your home as a kid as a pretty loud place. You were the youngest of five kids. There was always a lot of activity going on around you. Did that sort of help connect you to where you are today?
I think so. And also an homage to my mom, who was a poet. I mean, listen, the house was chaotic. The kids were, you know, there were animals and friends coming and going. I mean, it was lively, let's say, but a kind of healthy chaos, not a chaos where you would just, you know, like lose yourself. But my mom was someone that I'd had to call her name maybe 20 times until I got her attention, because she was the one immersed in books. She was the one that would sit on the couch. She has a special chair that she sat on. And I'd say, Mom, 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 you know, 20 times until she would lift her eyes from the page and actually say, what?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She was completely lost in poems and thoughts and books. And she was an omnivorous reader of everything. And she was the one really who introduced us to poetry. And we still have, you know, she's since passed, of course, but We still have her books in Brazil. And they're, you know, I feel awful that I go through the books and they're little pencil markings and things and drawings that we did on these beautiful books that she had, you know, poetry books. But it means we were allowed to touch them. And I think that really makes a difference also, made a difference in my life, is the fact that she left those books laying around and it was a part of the decor of the house, was piles of books and things that we could actually touch and maybe even, you know, when you missed white paper to draw on, you could draw on a little book, you know.
Well, you never really had a chance. As you just said, your mom was a poet, your father was a composer and a bossa nova guitarist, and here you are, right?
Right. And I think, you know, it was inevitable for all my siblings to be connected to music. They all have gone into music, you know, in different levels of music production and, you know, concert production as well. So we've all been connected to music because it was how they made a living, but it was also really their lives. I mean, everything was around music and it was fed by music and it was celebrated with music. And when you have that, which I feel like I have with my son now, and my husband's also a musician, so it feels like our household is always dealing with music in some way. Either I'm going on the road, so I'm preparing music, my husband is producing a record, my son is going to his piano lesson, or you know, there's always something that deals with that. And I'm very happy. I have no hope that he will be a professional musician. I actually would like him not to. I'd like
Why?
Him to be, well, because it's a hard life. It really is. I mean, it's a lovely life if you can make it, but very few of us actually get to make it. But I want him to have music in his life. I think that just like poetry, it's a very, very important thing to have music as a friend, music as a partner, and music as a place of solace and a right. place where you go to celebrate, but also to feel.
Luciana Souza performs The Book of Longing at 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Folly Theater downtown. For tickets, go to follytheater.org. Luciana, what's the trick to setting some of these poems to music?
I would say to find a rhythm for, you know, not to just read the poem and scant the poem in a you know, as if you were in an English class, but to really find if there's a rhythm, an underlying rhythm to the words and to the phrases, and then go to an instrument that feels truthful. So, for example, the song, the piece we just heard, A Night Song, I actually wrote that on a thumb piano, not on the regular piano, not on a guitar, which is usually what I do. So I try to play instruments that are different, that will give me a different sense of rhythm or flow. A lot of when I set poetry to music, a lot of it comes out as a ballad or something slow because you're dealing with words that are just kind of floating up there and you have to bring them down. So it's kind of hard to, it's not rap in that way where I would put a beat and then just speak on top. I am really trying to find something that's melodious, and inevitably I find something in medium to a slow tempo. So sometimes I force myself into going to a different instrument to find a different rhythm. But I think rhythm is key. And then melodically, it just kind of speaks to you, or the melody has, I'm sorry, the words will have a way of describing something. And you can be literal if somebody says, you know, because I fell in love or something. The melody could actually go down, falling down or not. So I try to play with these ideas. But I have, you know, I've done it enough now that I feel more confident. I still don't know if it's successful in that way or compositionally, but I feel more free with the process.
I wanted to play another track from The Book of Longing, and I was interested in the track Alms. Before we play it, tell us about this particular track.
So it's about love, as if it's a lot of poetry is about love. I would say 99.9% of it, because it's where I think we feel most comfortable, you know, letting our feelings out. But this is about love as it's in the winter of love. So this relationship where this love is really at a place where it's feeling cooler and it's feeling the person is inside and the world is changing outside. So as you go into winter and you go through winter, what happens to this love?
Yeah, boy, that idea of winter and love, just the two words together, are, you know, it's chilling. The last verse, but it is winter with your love. I scatter crumbs upon the sill and close the window, and the birds may take or leave them as they will. Let's play Alms from The Book of Longing.
My heart is what it was before, a house where people come and go. But it is winter with your love, the sashes are beset with snow. I light the lamp and lay the cloth. I blow the coals to blaze again. But it is winter with your love. The frost is thick upon the pane. I know winter when it comes. The leaves are listless on the boughs. I watched your love a little while and brought my plants into the house. I water them and turn them south. I snap the dead brown from the stem. But it is winter with your love. I only tend.
Singer Luciana Souza is my guest. She performs at the Folly Theater on Saturday night. You know, Downbeat once said of you, Luciana, that you tend to do your best work when accompanied by a spare number of instruments. You know, here we're just listening to you with a guitar and a bass, the same trio you're bringing with you to the Folly on Saturday. You know, that strikes me as such a risky place to live because there is nowhere to hide.
And that's what I love about it, that
really?
Everything is so, yeah, it's so exposed. And so you have the decay of the sound on the voice, on the bass, on the guitar. But you also have the percussiveness of it. And I play some hand percussion. But I love the fact that we're all exposed. And so there's the sound of acoustic instruments. Again, in a life, you know, in our lives nowadays, everything is so processed and everything is just so, in a way, fake. That just to be able to just take a breath and sing on top of very few instruments is, again, an act of faith and love for this art form. You know, I really love just exposing the sound of the voice with its frailty, but also its strength. And the same thing with the instruments. And I'm dealing with some musicians, you know, Chico Pinheiro on guitar, Brazilian guitarist who I'm bringing to Kansas City, and also Scott Colley on the bass, a phenomenal bass player.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people have such command of the instrument. They're so brilliant, so creative, so composers, really, on the instrument, moment after moment, that it makes the music so rich. I feel like I miss nothing. And I think for the audience, there's something beautiful, almost voyeuristic, about coming to a concert like that, because you really can't hide. So everything that we do is revealed. And that's an interesting aspect of, as a performer, that I like to show people also.
You began your professional career at age 3, singing jingles for radio and television. Age 3, Luciana?
Yeah, both my mom and dad were, you know, they worked at a jingle house, and so they needed a voice. You know, of course, I was singing about candy and dolls and, you know, whatever they needed, but it was the greatest school I could have asked for. I mean, I was in the studio multiple days a week, and as I grew as a young person and then a teenager, I was a professional singer already and had, you know, hours of under my belt of just singing in studio with great musicians. And I love having had that experience. I'm also very comfortable in studio. So when I go make a record, I mean, it's my happiest place. You know, I'm not afraid of, and when they solo my voice, I like what it sounds like.
You know, you won a lot of awards early in your career. What kind of impact did that have on your self-confidence?
I mean, my ego, of course, you know, you deal with that on a day-to-day basis. Some days it's up and down. So beyond that, I think it legitimized me to myself as a jazz singer. You know, coming from Brazil and not being a traditional jazz singer, singing shooby-dooby-dooby, you know, doing traditional jazz, which I love and do from time to time, but not all the time. It just legitimized me as somebody who was doing something that was a little more experimental. And I appreciated that from my peers and from the critics. So I'm not somebody who now reads a lot of criticism, because I feel like at this point, I'm 53 now, I feel like, listen, let me just do what I think is right and it's good and it has value. But early on, it was really important. And I feel like it has helped other people come after me. One of the things that happens after you turn 50, and it's happened for me, is that I feel like it's my responsibility also to lift people. So when I tell my story, when I go to schools, I teach a great deal. I was just last week in Boston teaching. And I tell people my story, they ask questions. I can also say, listen, my trajectory, my life has been different. But I've been awarded these things, which has made me believe in myself. And I want you to feel the same way, that it's possible for you. Mm-hmm. Grammys or no Grammys, just keep doing what you believe in. And it sounds shallow, but it really is the truth. For an artist, you have to just keep going.
I was going to say, that's what it's supposed to be, right? And just following your own instinct compared to somebody else's and just doing what you think it's all about.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, Steve, honesty, your own honesty, your own truth. You know this because you're on the air every day. I mean, you have to be yourself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it makes no sense,
right.
You know? And so musically, I have to be myself. And it's a tough, I mean, every once in a while, you're tempted to just, what if I do this? What if I chase that? The moment I start going through that, I have to really stop myself and say, it's not going to work because it won't be me. Yeah. It just won't be me. And then the response will be something that has no value, really.
Now, your voice has been compared to Joni Mitchell's, and there's some irony there because your husband, producer Larry Klein, you've referred to him here, once was married to her. What does Larry Klein bring to your music?
Well, he's a highly intelligent person, musically and otherwise. I mean, he's really a great musician, a bass player, but also such an experienced person in things that I'm not experienced at. So he knows repertoire like nobody. I mean, he knows everything about pop music and a ton about jazz. So he's like a fountain of you know, things for me to go and drink from, really. And then he's just a brilliant guy. So I think Joni was very lucky to have had him for 10 years. I've had him for more. And he's the husband I'm sticking with because I had one before him too. So I'm fully committed.
Good for you.
And I'm going forward. But we've been together now 14 years and we have a son. And that's an experience that also, you know, that he's had only with me. And I feel very happy about that we get to watch this child grow. And it's just brilliant. But I think for me, you know, going back home every time I go home, I know I'm finding a friend, a partner, but somebody who gets what I do.
Right.
And somebody who appreciates my creativity, like he appreciates Joni. Well. I mean, they're still good friends. And you know, there's nothing more important for him than her creativity, than the fact that what she created, her body of work. You know?
Right. Well, Luciana Souza performs The Book of Longing, 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Folly Theater. Tickets, follytheater.org. Luciana, what a pleasure to have you here. I really enjoyed the conversation. And,
same with
so
me.
So many
Thank
folks
you
looking forward
much.
To seeing you Saturday night. You
Thank
bet.
You, Steve. Thank you very much.
We'll go out with Luciana Souza singing When We Dance from her 2007 album, The New Bossa Nova. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.